Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of January. Well, the presidential race is going to go on and on and on and on. And if what happened to Barack Obama in the last couple weeks is any indication, it may be true that there is a huge chance that a candidate may be ruined by a story that he or she has not anticipated. Not that Barack Obama has been ruined here, but it's a very interesting story. And it took a long time to find out exactly what the truth was here. Evidently, a couple weeks ago, the Insight, which is the last remnant of a conservative print magazine that's owned by the Reverend Sun Young Moon's Unification Church, was able to set off a whole wave of talk radio, conversation, TV commentary, official denials, investigations by journalists around the globe, and media meta-criticism that lasted for almost a couple weeks. The controversy started with this article on the Insight website asserting that the presidential campaign of Hillary Clinton had prepared a charge that Barack Obama had covered up a period that he had spent in an Islamic religious school in Indonesia when he was 6 years old. His descriptions of the school were that it was a secular Indonesian public school, and there was no evidence that Clinton's campaign planned to spread such allegations. The author of the report declined to say whether he had learned the identity of his reporter's sources, implying that perhaps only the reporter knew the origin of the article's anonymous quotes and assertions. And it was picked up by people like Rush Limbaugh. It was picked up heavily by Fox News, and Fox later said that they had erred by citing the Clinton-Obama report, but that it's time to get over this. But, of course, the question is now how politically charged and very wrong information can be spread through the constant chatter of cable news, through blogs on the internet that are picked up by the mainstream media. And this is a race that's going to go, as you well know, on and on and on and on. We don't vote until November of 2008. So we thought we would look at all of this and welcome your phone calls. We have a great guest for it with us. Professor McChesney is here. Professor Robert McChesney is in the Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Information and Library Science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He hosts a radio show as a frequent guest here on the Ideas Network, and he's founder of the Free Press, has written many books on media reform, and we will welcome phone calls. I think we're going to get a lot of them on this because we can go back to the Swift Boat days and Jennifer Flowers and all kinds of different issues. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor McChesney, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
So you get this thing on the blog. It's not true. It's picked up by Rush Limbaugh. It's picked up by Fox News. And before you know it, then you got, I think it was ABC or CNN, who went to Jakarta to find out what the story is. But, you know, pretty soon the public assumes that this is true, even though it's not true, because so much time has been spent with people reiterating that this is a true story. I mean, it's kind of messy, isn't it?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head in the way you framed that question, which is, the fact that it's a bogus story isn't really the issue. The issue, you know, that doesn't really matter, because in the long scheme of things, the goal here, I think, of people who are trying to do damage to Obama or even to Hillary Clinton, for that matter, the idea that there's just this controversy out there for some people who aren't paying much attention, and I think most Americans probably pay very little attention to this, but they just see, oh, Obama's in some scandal here about, you know, Islamic terrorism. That's, you know, just planting that seed is sufficient. And I think, you know, your analogy to the Swift Boat episode in September 2004 is quite accurate, because there you had a similar phenomenon in which a bogus story was planted through a series of ads and getting an echo effect through talk radio and then cable news. And by doing that, pretty much it forced the balance of the news media to take up the story and make it an issue, like the Obama story here. And then it becomes this sort of big story, and people assume if it's getting that much coverage, there's something to it. The truth is in the middle.
Yeah. But why is it that people wouldn't check their sources? Isn't that one of the first rules of journalism? Check out what you're saying.
Well, yeah. This is dreadful journalism. And I mean, it's indefensible journalism. I think it would make any journalist's skin crawl. And I, without being flippant, I mean, look at where the so-called journalism is being produced. And the origins of it and the purveyors of it initially, the first wave, came from media that have a clear political axe to grind and aren't known for really fact-checking, aren't known for taking mm-hmm. journalism very seriously. They're known for being more interested in pushing a particular agenda, and the truth is sort of second or third or fourth on their list of criteria for picking stories. Reason, or whatever that magazine's called, that the Reverend Moon has, Fox News, Rush Limbaugh. You know, the batting average for truth for that media is significantly lower, I think, than good journalism would like.
Right. And then you've got the political director at Fox who just dismisses the whole thing after they've carried this story, which is, you know, a damaging story. Get it right on this. And he says, well, you can't say it's right or wrong. It's just different. We acknowledge that. We acknowledge the error with the Obama thing, and let's just move on.
Well, you know, that's depressing, too. You would hope there would be a much harder internal review of what would allow such a lame story to be on the air. And, I mean, again, I think this is an episode that points why the Fox News Channel is, I think, increasingly seen as basically an ideological arm of you know, a particular political viewpoint. You know, one of the ways I view Fox News, you know, I'll give you a good story about that, Kathleen. When Katrina happened and hit New Orleans, you know, I wanted to know what the Bush administration position would be, how they would be, frankly, spinning it. And I turned to Fox News because I said, well, if there's anywhere I'm going to get the government line. And so Fox News, in a way, has come to play the role that in authoritarian societies and in dictatorships, the state television station plays, where if you want to get sort of the official line of the government, that's where you go. And I think in many respects that's the role they've assumed with the Republican Party, is that they're basically going to carry their water, and that's their first and most important criteria. I think it's, you know, it's a relatively new development. We've certainly had bias in our television news media, and it's been studied by myself and countless other scholars. But, I mean, sort of a shameless bias, like we're describing here with the Obama story or earlier with the Swift boats. Is relatively new. I mean, you'd have to go back really to the first half of the 20th century to find that as commonplace in American journalism.
Mm-hmm. What about this? And I'm wondering if campaigns have become so vicious. What part the campaigns in putting forward some of this information? I know they have opposition research staffs, and they're looking for damaging information about their opponents. And we've heard about dirty tricks in campaigns for years and years and years. But are they responsible for disseminating some untruths as well?
Well, I don't know the specifics of this story well enough to say, but certainly the way politics works in America today, I think candidates have to play offense and they have to be ready to play defense at this level. This is an important part of politics. It has been for a long time. I think the real issue to me here is less that than the fact that if candidates aren't really aggressively pushing issues that matter to people and trying to really get the discussion on those sorts of issues, they leave themselves open to this, and this is the sort of game they participate in. And what I mean by that is, you know, I get the sense personally, and I've been very frustrated by this presidential race for both sides so far this year, and this story typifies it. I get the sense that most of these candidates are being very timid. They're afraid to say anything more than soundbites, sort of a focus group tested
comments.
And if you're going to play it safe like that, with sort of a rope-a-dope, and not really go out and engage people on issues that matter to people, then I think it's very short path to when your political campaigns devolve into this sort of garbage. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if Obama and Hillary, in this case, aren't going to actually take understandable, coherent positions on the war in Iraq that contrast them with this administration or from each other, so they're not really debating that. That's off the table. Then, you know, if they're not going to do that on the economy or the environment except for focus group tested banal statements, then we're pretty much reduced to this sort of junk.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw Chris Matthews last night, but I got to tell you, they went on and I thought, oh my gosh, are we going to get this until November now of 2008 on this long story about some comment that Hillary Clinton made in Iowa that may have tried to play to the female vote, guys in their past who had done them wrong. It was a comment that she gave to laughs, talking about how she could deal what in her past would allow her to be able to deal with evil guys. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the audience, you know, immediately thought of her husband, her philandering husband, and who knows if she meant him when she said that, although she seems pretty calculating, and probably she did. But all the women in the audience laughed. And I got to tell you, the commentators went on for 20 minutes on this story, Bob. 20 minutes. And I thought, oh my gosh, is it going to be hundreds and hundreds of days of this?
You know, I'm afraid it probably is, because I think you, again, I think what you observed is not an exception, but it's the rule, which is that our pundit class and cable television news, where a lot of the discourse goes on about candidates now, I mean, that's really where, for the most part, if you're interested in politics and you're following the presidential race in 2008, your news fix is either coming from the internet or it's coming from cable news. Mm-hmm. And that's where the punditocracy talks about it. And regrettably, the vast majority of what's talked about is this sort of, I think, fairly irrelevant stuff. It's trivia. It's easy to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's easy to gossip about.
Right. Gossip.
And, you know, it doesn't really help us as a society. It's not really the sort of stuff that's going to help us get out of the great problems this country faces.
Right. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, we've touched something that you want to talk about, because our lines are all filled. So we'll start taking calls. And just remember the number. You got to be able to get through eventually. We go to Jim from Ashland for our first call. Bob, hi, Jim.
Good morning. Hey, my comment would be, and a question is, how can I determine fact from fiction anymore? When your news networks are picking up blogs that have, you know, there's no credibility to them after they've reported on it for, you know, 3 or 4 days. And then there's nothing that comes back, and they say they're wrong. This is, you know, the fact. And they just run with this stuff, and it's like the interest lasts for two or three days. And then they change the subject, and it goes somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the tip of the iceberg. We just started. And how can the average voter figure out what's fact from fiction?
Right. Find out the truth. That's an important question.
It really is. And I wish I had an answer for you, Jim, that I could say, go to this website or do A and B and you'll be fine. But I don't. I think that the demands on citizens now and on voters are very high for exactly that reason. I think the lack of quality information and the lack of accountability is really becoming a problem, and I don't have an easy answer. I would say that there's more of a responsibility on voters now to really get a range of viewpoints and to be very skeptical, even of media that you may have traditionally trusted or held in high regard. To instantly be skeptical, ask who the sources are, and in the case of political races, I mean, you know, really, I think the key thing for all of us is to try to keep our focus on what the actual shape of this country is, that we've got a war going on, the economy, we've got an environmental crisis, we have education problems. We have a whole list of serious concerns about the future of this country. And, you know, any stuff that gets very far off that, I think pretty much try to just ignore.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be my guess, because it's really a distraction from what we ought to be thinking about. And I think we ought to force our candidates as much as we can to stay with what really matters as well.
Mm-hmm. Is that helpful, Jim? Jim's gone. Thanks for the call.
I don't think I was much help to Jim. He probably hung up in despair. I wish I had a good answer for him.
I think that gave him a little bit of hope, I think. And you've written extensively about the fact that we just don't get, particularly on the local level, Professor McChesney, we don't get a whole lot of very detailed stories. You talk about the smaller number of extremely profitable companies determining what we read, and they don't have any oversight, and so you don't get a whole open debate about a lot of issues, and you don't get, you know, I look at what's happening to newspapers, like in the city of Milwaukee, and they're cutting the amount of news that we're getting, so that it's like USA Today, and there aren't any complete stories, and there isn't a healthy debate of what's going on. To live in a democracy, you need some people who are out there really getting the story.
You know, we're really in a crisis in this country. This is one of the biggest crises of our media. And now we've been talking on this show about the coverage of the presidential race. And the presidential race gets an inordinate amount of the media coverage, the journalism attention. And what we talk about isn't the amount of coverage, it's just how bad it is, how much it focuses on trivia and how little we actually learn about candidates and how little we force candidates to really articulate coherent positions on the issues that matter and how little our media does that. And we'll talk about that a lot today. But the other side of the coin is what you're getting at, which is even more serious, which is the fact that in study after study shows that the amount of coverage in broadcast and print media of all the other races, especially the state and local races, has absolutely fallen off the map. I mean, the studies that have been done at the University of Southern California by Marty Kaplan and his researchers, they've actually gone around the country and calculated the amount of coverage of in local news broadcasts of elections in their community, including president and senate and governor, not to mention local races. And the amount of coverage is almost non-existent. Basically, what we see in America is that in race after race, the only information people are getting from broadcast media is coming from TV ads. And the information they're getting from newspapers is shrinking, and it's largely spin analysis, very little on issues. So voters are increasingly left with little oxygen to breathe to participate in the system. And, you're just getting spun around by TV ads and slogans and then cable news on the races they do cover, largely punditry on trivia.
We're talking with Professor Bob McChesney this hour of the show. He's at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, a professor in the Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Information and Library Science. He hosts a radio show there, Media Matters, and has written extensively many books on media reform. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're starting with, and we're branching into other areas as well, but the idea for the program came from the blog that appeared on Reverend Sun Young Moon's website that talked about Barack Obama and how he attended a radical Islamic school when he was 6 years old living in Indonesia. It was picked up by Fox News Channel. It was picked up by Rush Limbaugh and conservative talk show hosts. And they took it a step further, saying that Hillary Clinton was behind all of this. Clinton said it's a lot of hooey. Barack Obama talked about what that school actually was. Finally, somebody sent a reporter to Jakarta, fancy that, to find out what the school was. Seems like a simple thing to do. And they found out that indeed it was a public school, secular school, and has long accepted students of all faiths. So it's only the beginning of the presidential season, and we're talking about other bloggers who mainstream media has picked up stories that have been wrong. I mean, they're just wrong. And here we are in the beginning of a long presidential campaign. Is this the kind of junk we're going to get day after day after day after day? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. To your phone calls in a moment, more of them on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the author of a terrific book. If you're in the field of education or you want to inspire your young person in your house or you want to be inspired as a teacher, the author of Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire, The Methods and Madness Inside Room 56, which is found in a very poor part of Los Angeles. The teacher has been there for well over 25 years, and he says about his students, I fear something for these students, and it's not gangs, it's not drugs. What I fear is that they're ordinary. I don't want my students to be ordinary. I want them to be extraordinary because I know they are. He's one heck of a teacher, and we'll talk about that after 10 o'clock. Okay, 800-486-8655 is the number, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Holland from Antioch, hi.
Hi, I'm so happy to be on the show. You guys are just absolutely amazing. I hope I don't take it too far off the subject, but I just wanted to ask the professor some personal things. I was in the State Historical Society, Wisconsin State Historical Society, in Madison for Mel Reynolds' talk on 9/11, various conspiracy and stuff. And, well, it was awesome because the previous caller that just called in, the first guy, he, you know, made some really good points, like facts from fiction, you know, in the news. Or, you know, he just said it was the tip of the iceberg. You know, these are little quotes I wrote down. It blows my mind because, like, he's very right. And, like, also the professor was all, you know, I wish I had an answer for you, Jim, you know, in this despair, you know, as he hung up on the phone. And, I mean, you guys are just absolutely, you know, brilliant, and you have the information, and information is everything. And really nobody knows anything, just like the, you know, everything's just this fed prepackaged. I mean, the majority of people is what I'm saying. It's like it's very hard to really filter down and educate yourself and have the passion and have this ridiculous drive to become like this lexicon of information, not just in partisan politics and, you know, just with everything. You know what I mean? The passion for anything. But my point is you know, all the focus is really on sports, right? and the gain, personal material possessions and gain, you know, personal gain. But that's, you know, society. And like what you just said with what you're going to have this radical teach with your hair on fire guy, who sounds fantastic. I never heard of him. I love his the way he says that. It's mind-blowing because, you know, this radical approach, he doesn't want his students to be ordinary. They want them to be extraordinary. Well, it's the pessimistic society that, you know, a lot of them are raised in. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, we're focused on money. Not everybody has it, right? And that's the whole thing. The orientation of all of the focus on partisan politics, elected officials and whatnot, and all the money that goes to it, you think we could distribute it and, you know, use it in a better way. But that's a bigger thing. But what I really want to ask you is with the partisan politics in particular and elected officials, the whole situation, I really think that it's kind of a big, you know, kind of, I don't know, a charade, I think, because there is an agenda. There is a premeditated, coordinated agenda by some sort of higher deep function. And like you said, everybody's scared. No one wants to speak up because it's too heavy, right? You know, anybody that really knows that's on the inside, you know, they know enough to know that they should keep their mouth shut. So, I mean, the range of viewpoints is so broad. And with Fox News, I mean, come on. Like you said, it's an appendage of the right wing, and just maybe that agenda, what I was speaking of before with the PNAC.
Right. All right. He brought up a lot of different areas there. Let me do a follow-up on you talk about Fox News. Is Fox News losing a little bit of its appeal because of things that have happened, like the Obama story, like the fact that people are onto the fact that if you want a government viewpoint, you go to Fox News? Or are they just they have a loyal audience who agrees with everything they say and they don't want to hear any viewpoint, and that audience will always stay at about 30% as the president's ratings are?
Well, I think that's all true again. I think that, you know, I don't know the latest rating numbers, but the research I've seen shows that the Fox audience has tapered off in the last year or so. Mm-hmm. But it still has a very loyal audience. It's an older audience. In fact, it's one of the real concerns for Fox News, and it's the same concern with the Republican Party more broadly, is that it skews much older than the general population.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but I think they're sort of in a bind in a way because they have a hardcore loyal following that I think very much likes these Obama stories and Swift Boat stories.
Mm-hmm.
And very much looks to it for refuge on the dial where they can go to get their perspective heard.
Right.
And, you know, people like that. And I think of all political viewpoints, everyone sort of likes having a home base in a way.
Yeah.
And I think so, but if they try to expand their audience to appeal to others, they might antagonize their base. And I think that's the dilemma they face. And I think we should understand that as partisan as Fox is, the owner of Fox, Rupert Murdoch, you know, he is, if nothing else, if not a capitalist, and one who's primarily concerned with making his wallet the fattest wallet on the planet Earth. And in these other countries where he's done business, like Britain, where he owns a lot of newspapers, and the satellite television system, the monopoly system, you know, he cozied up to the Labor Party once he saw they were going to come into power. And he's gotten actually quite cozy with Hillary Clinton, did a fundraiser for her. And so I think there's nothing in his business model, he would have no trouble moving toward being pro-democratic, certainly centrist Democratic,
mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton. I think what's probably stopping him now at Fox is simply that for economic reasons, that would be disastrous because it would antagonize their core market,
mm-hmm.
as small as it is.
Don't you get tired of this centrist business? You know, I'm with you when you talk earlier about people getting up there and just telling us really what they think about things, and dump these focus groups and dump saying I'm a part of the middle. I grew up in middle America. I'm middle class. We're governing from the middle. I mean, everybody says that that's what the American people want. And yet I think we also want some fire in the belly. We want somebody who stands for something.
Well, I think most Americans, from my experience, want to get rid of these silly labels, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think when you get rid of the labels about centrist, middle, moderate, that everyone claims, and just start talking about actual issues that matter, I mean, what's a centrist position on health care? What's a centrist position on the war in Iraq? What's a centrist position on education? These are real problems mm-hmm. that involve human lives that require real solutions, and labels aren't really clarifying anything. In fact, they're just a way of covering up the unwillingness to take a position on a tough issue. You know, I think there's really this pressure to be centrist or to be middle of the road that politicians feel, that they all swear to, comes not really from the American people. I don't think that's like a driving thing. People are waking up in the morning and say, gee, I want someone who's in the middle of the road. I think it comes much more from two factors. One, big money, which drives so much of our politics, and that's sort of the safest route. You sort of, if you say you're in the middle of the road, you want to antagonize money. You won't be taking positions that'll threaten the funds coming into your campaign coffers. And secondly, I think the news media take a lot of the blame here. I think the news media really have a strong centrist bias. And by centrist, I don't mean they look at sort of the range of all possible positions and say, well, the truth's in the middle. As much as I say they really are, anything that falls outside of the conventional wisdom of Washington at the time is looked at extremely skeptically. And so any candidate who does take chances is probably has a very good chance that not only Fox News, but Chris Matthews and CNN was sort of like, what's with this guy or gal? What are they doing saying something crazy like this? And I think that's a real disciplinary effect on candidates. If they know if they take chances, they're probably going to get sliced and diced in the commercial news media.
Mm-hmm. And yet you got somebody, it's interesting, MSNBC has become a place maybe of refuge for people more labeled on the left. You got somebody like Keith Olbermann who has really gone to town here, and his ratings have gone up significantly, taking on the Bush administration.
Yeah, I mean, Olbermann's been one of the great stories of the past year or so. I think a lot of people have been following his success. And I think he speaks to what you were talking about earlier, which is just the fact that he's speaking candidly, and you're hearing sort of someone just speaking from the heart as well as the brain, and just sort of trying to say what they honestly think is going on, rather than couch it in all sorts of jargon that's incomprehensible, or to talk about, you know, Britney Spears, or whether, you know, Obama brushes his teeth enough, or this sort of junk, but actually talk about real issues.
Right.
I think that is so exciting for people. Even if you don't agree with Keith Olbermann, you're pleased that there's someone who's talking to you like you're an intelligent human being and not like someone who's in a focus group is being manipulated to buy toothpaste.
Thanks so much for the call, Holland. Let's go next to Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Mr. McChesney, it's a pleasure to talk with you. I've read some of your work put out by Seven Stories Press. You're certainly a breath of fresh air. I guess just my comment, and this will lead to my question, then I'll take your response off the air. On Joy Cardine's show, I believe it was last week, she talked about where it seems Americans from both the right and the left have become just a lot more angry, a lot more upset. I think you first saw this in the right in the early to mid 90s with the rise of Bill Clinton and then the right wing backlash. And it seemed like they were just trying to get him to a lot of people every which way they could. They couldn't defeat him in the second term. And so then you had the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal. And then I think when you saw it from the left, I think that started after the 2000 election. There was a lot of questions there. And I know that after the 2004 election, many people on the left, I think, were upset. They lost faith in the voting system. And my question is this. There's a lot of outlets, whether it be Fox, for instance, but maybe even some on the left might be guilty of this, of tapping into those emotions and trying to, you know, generate whatever. I'll take my comments up here. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
Well, it's a terrific question by Boyd. And I don't think there's a simple answer. I do think, though, to link up the right and left and equate them as sort of two sides of the same coin that both have similar flaws is a little misleading. And it's not that one is better than the other, but I think they both operate in very different frameworks than the other. And so, for example, by left, if we mean political left, that would be the left wing of the Democratic Party, for example, not the whole Democratic Party, but the left wing of them. By right, we mean the right wing of the Republican Party. I think they both have very different power bases in our society. The political right has an enormous media apparatus It has a lot of people in power in Washington, in political power, and has had tremendous influence. It's controlled the White House and controls much of the judiciary. And until the 2006 election, it was the leaders of Congress for much of the past 12 years. And so that was one, you know, that's contrasted with, you know, Dennis Kucinich and Jesse Jackson and that crowd, which would be sort of the equivalent on the left. And it's hard to put the two together or MoveOn.org and say that they sort of balance each other and have similar foibles. So I think that it's difficult to answer it at that level. I do think the question about anger, clearly there's a tremendous amount of anger from both communities, and anger has really fueled the right, as far as I can tell, for the last 15 years. The anger towards Clinton was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the issues, you know, again, are quite separate between the right-wing's concerns with Bill Clinton and the left's concerns, and not just the left, but I think increasingly the bulk of the population's concerns with the Bush administration. In one case, you're talking about you know, sort of lifestyle choices about Bill Clinton that they found objectionable, alleged lifestyle choices. And in the other case, you're talking about someone who's talking about war and peace and the global economy and the environment. I mean, there's really, like, in my, whatever one thinks, the issues that drive the unpopularity of George W. Bush aren't about, you know, whether he had an affair. They're about, you know, war and peace. They're about the economy. They're about the future of our species on this planet. And I didn't get the sense those were the issues at all around Bill Clinton.
Right. And what about the issues around Hillary Clinton? Will the right make those same kinds of issues, the counterculture, you know, feminism, this isn't a woman's job, her bringing up those Vince Foster and all of that? Is that going to play again now? Is that going to be their tactic, do you think?
Well, we'll see. I certainly would think so. I think that, you know, that has been the play they've been running. You know, I think in the case of Hillary Clinton, we have this strange anomaly. On one hand, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh on Fox News and Sean Hannity and that crowd, I mean, you would think Hillary Clinton went to the Vladimir Lenin School of Politics. You would think she was, like, so far out in the left wing that, you know, Fidel Castro saw her whiz by to his left. And so you have this world of, you see, like a lesbian feminist who wants to end marriage and abolish the church. And then, you know, you've got the reality of Hillary Clinton, which is a conservative Democrat who's pro-war, who's pro-business, who is by no means someone who stuck her neck out to take on powerful interests in our society, who really is much closer to Joe Lieberman than she is to a liberal Democrat. And so I don't know which, you know, she's fighting to say she's actually trying to tell the truth. I'm not a radical. She isn't. But then, why should people vote for her? I mean, that's the question then. And I think that's sort of the issue she's got to wrestle with and voters have to wrestle with. What exactly do we have with Hillary?
Mm-hmm. Jerry from Waterford, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to come to the defense of Fox a little bit because I think they bring up some issues that maybe some of the other news media doesn't bring up, and that's the reason that people listen to them as well as listening to the mainframe media. I think a lot of public radio, I think you guys do a great job, but you had a show on in which you spent a whole hour on whether Bush and Cheney were involved in the 9/11. In fact, you had
I never had such a show on. I wouldn't put such a show on.
Well, public radio did.
Yeah, so why do you like Fox?
Well, the point I'm bringing up is that they bring up issues which maybe the other media doesn't bring up. Sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong, but at least they bring that to the forefront. And I'm saying that you can't knock them just for one program, which maybe, or for one story, which you didn't agree with, and which may be untrue because, you know, news media, that's their job. They're bringing these stories up.
Yeah, but
don't they
have an obligation? And I would fault public radio for giving much validity to this conspiracy 9/11 thing too. I just don't think we get flooded with calls because we're considered the only outlet that would explore a story like that. I don't think it's worthy of exploring. But don't you find it as a viewer objectionable for a place like Fox for a long period of time to run with this Obama story without checking out, which wasn't that hard, the facts of the story and promoting something that was not true? I don't care if it's NPR or or Fox or whatever as somebody who values journalism and finding out what's going on in the world, I think that's a bad thing.
I agree with you 100%. But what I'm saying is that Fox isn't the only one who has done that type of thing, and including public radio, which I think a lot of, you know.
Professor McChesney, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you're both right. I think definitely if we don't have standards for accuracy, then, you know, what do we have? But we have to hold everyone. If we're going to take anyone seriously so we can pay any attention to their stories coming through their medium, be it television, print, or internet, or radio, we have to basically be able to trust that they're doing their best to make sure they're getting the story right. And as soon as we assume they aren't, then we have every right to say, well, I'm going to stop paying much attention to them.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, is it a good thing that we have media from different perspectives so, you know, they're going to be more inclined to go after stories that other media might miss? I think, sure. I think that's a healthy thing for our society.
Sure.
And so I think the caller is absolutely right. But I think the my sense is that Fox's batting average with regard to truth is a lot lower than NPR's. And I've been quite critical of NPR over time. But I think in this case, you know, this sort of willful disregard for the truth to sort of get a story out there early is pretty shameful.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. We got to pause for a moment. We'll return. Professor Bob McChesney is our guest. We're talking about, well, we've gone beyond this, but we're talking about the presidential campaign and how stories have been surfacing that are completely untrue about where Barack Obama went to school when he was 6 years old. And it took a little while to find out where those stories were coming from. They came from a blog on an internet site that is associated with the Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church. And then the story got further complicated or further spread that it was Hillary Clinton who was saying that he went to this right-wing madrasa school, which was not true. He said it wasn't true. And finally somebody sent a reporter and found out that this indeed was a secular school accepting students of all faiths. But it had, you know, its staying power on Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and found its way to the mainstream media. So you had mainstream media reporting on the story as well. You wonder where the American people, where their thoughts are about this. If nobody, people don't follow the news as closely as all of us do. But in passing, perhaps they heard this and figure that he's some kind of wild guy. So we're talking about all of that and welcoming your phone calls. Our lines have been just very full, but keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now for Professor McChesney. Oh, first, though, let me tell you that Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire, The Methods and Madness Inside Room 56, the second hour of our program. If you need inspiration as a teacher, you're going to get it the second hour of our program. And I do want to tell you that we will be having presidential candidates. It's early, I know, but Iowa Governor, former Governor Tom Vilsack will be with us tomorrow during the 10 o'clock hour. Okay. Back to phone calls, and we go next to Judith from Waukesha. Hello, Judith.
Hello, Kathleen. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Thank you so much for putting me on. I have a real incident to relay regarding Fox News in Waukesha, of all places. We have a vigil that's for nonviolence that's been continuous since November of 2001, every Sunday in front of the library. And about a year and a half ago, Fox News came with a TV camera and a reporter, and they also brought three counter-protesters. And they tried to yell at us and make us yell back so they could get that on camera that the peace people were being violent, as it were. And we, fortunately, we were aware that such a thing could happen. We all stepped back almost in unison and did not engage at all, and the reporter's name was Bob, and because I'm one of the leaders, he came over to me and was really yelling at me, and he said, I disagree with everything you think, and he was wanting a response from me, but I said very quietly, go to church, Bob, and he got more angry, and then I waited a little while, and I said again, go to church, Bob, and after a few minutes, they folded their equipment up and went away and took their protesters with them.
That's a bizarre story. So they actually brought these people to your place?
Yes.
What do you think of that, Professor McChesney?
Well, what can you say? you know, I can't really add much to that. That story speaks for itself. But what I can say is that, you know, one of the dilemmas that has faced people, protesters in our society, especially large protests against matters like the war in Iraq, has been that the way the press coverage has worked traditionally is that when it covers the demonstration, it feels obliged to cover the so-called counter-demonstration.
Right, even though there are 10 people there.
Yeah, so you'll have, you know, literally in the case of the anti-Iraq war demonstrations over the last few years, including the one this past weekend, hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating. Then all you need to do is collect 35 people or 25 people, you know, somewhere in the same town counter-protesting, and they get mentioned and they get a photo. And it sort of is, it's this absurd sense of balance. And I think, you know, one of the tragedies of our journalism today has been that, you know, protesters, people come together, citizens, everyday people come together to try to weigh in, take advantage of their First Amendment right to assemble, to redress grievances with people in power. And it's harder and harder for that to get taken seriously in our news media. The news media is sort of ho-hum. That's barely a story anymore.
Right.
And I really contrast that to the period I grew up in, the late 1960s, early 1970s, when major demonstrations, when you had several hundred thousand people gather in Washington, became stories that the whole country talked about. That was something that was very serious. Today, I think our news media allow this country to sort of ignore having that public discussion about this war by taking those demonstrators seriously.
Thanks so much for the call, Judith. And we go next to Rick from La Crosse. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Kathleen. I just have two comments. I hope that this does not discredit legitimate bloggers and legitimate, honest news aggregators like Common Dreams and Axis of Logic on the Internet.
Well, before you go on, does it? I wonder if it does have that effect, Professor
McChesney. I hope it doesn't.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, on the other hand, I'm very gratified that there are people like Keith Olbermann in the mainstream media who actually can speak English, like George Galloway when he came over here and he gave Norm Coleman a dressing down. The only one in English, I think, in America that speaks English like that, like he means it, like it comes from the viscera, is Keith Olbermann. And I can only think of George Galloway in the same sentence, you know. What do you think about Mr. McChesney? And I respect your opinion because Bill Moyer says good things about you, and I worship the ground he walks on.
Well, I think your point about Keith Olbermann, which you talked about, is absolutely right. He does speak with a clarity and a candor and an honesty that comes from both the heart and brain that is rare, and I think because of that, it's why people are responding to him as favorably as they are. And I think it's interesting about Keith Olbermann, and it's worth noting what's sort of depressing about Keith Olbermann is that, you know, had he been doing that from day one, he probably wouldn't be on the air. He wouldn't have gotten a job
exactly. Prior
to doing that.
Exactly.
I mean, he was on the air for years and years. And he, you know, I'm a sports fan, and he was a phenomenal sportscaster at ESPN before he moved over and started doing news. But he was really years before he sort of developed this shtick. So he was able to stay on the air, develop somewhat of an audience. And then once he started doing this, he had a big audience built in that could grow quickly, and they couldn't really yank him. But I fear that there's no way someone walking off the street doing a Keith Olbermann shtick 2 years ago or a year and a half ago could have possibly gotten on the air at MSNBC.
Yeah. What about his point that legitimate bloggers who may be really in the pursuit of truth are going to be hurt by these other bloggers who are just putting out supposed facts willy-nilly?
Well, I don't think it's not like the bloggers have that sort of stellar reputation to begin with. And I think it's such a diverse, such a heterogeneous community, even regardless of one's political viewpoints, that even with any possible political vantage point, there are going to be some bloggers who are going to be regarded as more credible. And we're in a winnowing out process now of sort of people figuring out which ones they're reliable and which aren't. And I think, for example, the one specific website the caller mentioned, commondreams.org, that's an aggregator of columns. And I think what they do is they just take stuff from around the web and from print media that's posted online. And I think they do a good job of editing it so they don't put something up that's garbage. I mean, they vet it. And so that's the sort of thing where you can trust them to have certain standards. And if they run something, you can be sure someone read it and checked it out before they put it up there. They're not going to put up crazy stuff.
Thanks, Rick, so much for the call. Jackie from Kenosha, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was hoping that the professor could comment or give more details on, it was an effort, but I think it was the 2000 election. All of the candidates agreed to follow certain rules of decorum and not to do the negative campaigning. Do you recall what that was? And can he comment on how we as Americans can try to organize? I don't know if you do it at the local level, if you write your congressman, what you do, but how can we tell the presidential candidates that, you know, we want you to agree to this, we want you to be civil, we want you to cover the facts and stick to the facts, and we want you to agree to that before you run? I mean, is it feasible to even make that an amendment to the Constitution?
Well, no, I don't think it probably is, and I don't think you get it passed. But I think the concern you have, Jackie, is exactly one that a lot of us have. And I think, you know, I've always had a fantasy. I'd like to have a thing where I'd say to a politician, I won't vote for you if you run any TV political ads. I mean, that'd be sort of... But the problem is I wouldn't have anyone to vote for. I think,
right,
you know,
right.
The libertarians.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think the problem we face is the structural factors that drive negative campaigning are so enormous that it's very frustrating for individual citizens or even organized groups of citizens to feel like you can really direct the course. So we end up, even the politicians we admire the most, end up playing the same game to a certain extent. And it's very depressing, and I think it really drives down interest in politics in our society. It drives down voting rates. It raises cynicism and demoralization. So I think, you know, you're absolutely right to be concerned about this.
Thanks, Jackie. Let's go to Bob from Whitewater. Hello, Bob.
Yeah, I'm going to pick on everybody. It should be obvious, but nobody ever brings it up. If you listen to all the anchors, right and left, primarily at night, and then the old big three that we used to listen to at 5 o'clock or 5:30 every night, all these anchors, and then also now the big national radio hosts, all these people are millionaires, and they're dispensing the news for us, and they go nowhere. They just sit and pontificate every night, and they have the same pontificating millionaires, and all the generals they get on are millionaires. Now let me pick on the small media. Let's just say, because everybody can relate to it, the Capital One Bowl. Let's say Wisconsin, which is, you know, I'm probably accurate here, between all the little media outlets, newspapers and radios and television, we probably send 100 people to the Capital One Bowl with budgets between $1,500 and $5,000, depending on how much crew they sent. So for one weekend, Wisconsin spent $250,000 on media for the Capital One Bowl for a football game. We've sent 10 people from Wisconsin, 10 journalists to Iraq, where we've lost 70 soldiers. Now, I went to Iraq as an independent journalist, the 11th journalist to go, and it cost me $3,000. So I think, in a way, we let millionaires dispense our news, and then all we're worried about is football games, and we say we're worried about our soldiers, but we've only sent 10 journalists over there. I think we deserve what we get.
Professor McChesney.
Well, I don't think we deserve what we get. I disagree with that, because I don't think we're getting what we would necessarily want. I think that the problem here isn't at the demand side, it's at the supply side. It's the fact that we have very powerful companies, a handful of them, that make their decisions about journalism and allocation of resources based on what they can make the most money doing. And I think that's what and then once people consume something, then they get a taste for it. So they want to know more about Angelina Jolie than they do about global warming or what we can do to solve the war in Iraq. So, I mean, but I think the caller's fundamental point I agree with completely, which is we have a real problem with the way journalism is organized in society. And I think the work I generally do, I normally talk about, is about the efforts of citizens to come together to create institutions so we can get better journalism, better media, so we have the tools and resources that we need if we're actually going to be a free society.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. One more call, running out of time. Sarah from Kiel, hi.
Hi. My question is in regards to the code of ethics for journalism. Is there a code of ethics that journalists must follow? Of course, there's an internal code, what's right, what's wrong, but how are journalists held accountable for what they write so that and how they disperse that writing, and I'll take comments off the air. Thank you.
Good question.
Well, there are codes of ethics that have been put together by various journalist groups. They're very impressive oftentimes, but it's not like being a lawyer or a doctor where if you violate the code, you can lose your license and not be able to practice anymore. Journalists are not regulated in that manner in the United States, so it's always informal and it's self-regulation. So that's where we're at.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was fun, Professor McChesney. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks. Enjoyed it. As always, Professor Bob McChesney, professor in the Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Information and Library Science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He hosts a radio show as well and has written lots of books on media reform. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your wonderful calls. A reminder that Wisconsin Public Radio will provide coverage of Governor Jim Doyle's State of the State address. That's tonight at 7 o'clock. WPR's Sean Johnson will anchor our coverage. And then tomorrow morning, you can join Joy Cardine, who will have extensive analysis of the State of the State. And Ben Marins will be focusing as well on what the governor said. So tune in tonight at 7 and tomorrow during the day. We'll have news coming up from National Public Radio and then another terrific hour on teaching. So please stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Net.